English Listening Comprehension Test, Spring 1993, A-Level. The test is in three parts, each of which you will hear twice, the first time straight through, and the second time in short sections. Between the sections in parts 1 and 2, you should answer the questions asked in the booklet by choosing the correct alternative answer, according to what you have heard, and marking it on the answer sheet. You will have about 20 seconds to look at each question beforehand and about 15 seconds in which to answer. In part 3, you will have to write short answers in English. The test is about to begin. Listen to the first part straight through.
Today in our studio, we have Mr. Arthur Miller, the famous playwright. Mr. Miller, where do you spend most of your time nowadays?
In Connecticut. Back in the 1950s, I bought 700 acres of land there, plus a farmhouse as old as the United States itself.
Arthur Miller's present wife, the photographer Inge Morath, has her studio in an old barn. There's a cottage where Mr. Miller can write undisturbed, and a well-equipped workshop. Mr. Miller is not merely a world-famous playwright, but also a first-rate carpenter. He's built all his bookcases himself. Mr. Miller, tell me something about your background.
I was born in 1915. My father, Isidore Miller, an illiterate Jewish clothing merchant, immigrated from Poland at the age of 7 and later made his fortune in New York. My father may have been unable to read, but he was all the better at counting money. But father lost most of his money in the Depression, and we moved from a luxury apartment to the relative poverty of Brooklyn. I used to work as a truck driver and a factory boy until I made my way to the University of Michigan.
There you won several literary prizes and came to realize that you had a knack for writing plays.
That's right, and I think the Depression sharpened my understanding of society and of people's suffering. But even so, prose has never come easily to me. My need to condense things developed early.
Mr. Miller, do you have some favorite critics?
Well, really, I have always detested the inhumanity of theater critics. The situation is actually worse than it was 20 or 30 years ago. The commercial theater manages to do all right, but no one wants to invest in quality. Today in America, theater is just showbiz.
When I read your autobiography, Time Bends, I got the impression that you have total recall regarding your own life.
But you have to understand, in my home, I was always considered the one with the worst memory. I've never kept a diary or done research for my autobiography. Everything I've written is just the way I remember it.
You have said that The Crucible, your most frequently performed play, measures the political climate of the country where it is played. Can you give me an example?
The Crucible, which is the story of a 17th century witch hunt and an allegory of McCarthyism in the 1950s, is often performed in countries afraid of dictatorship or where a dictatorship has just ended. In Poland, in the mid-80s, several government officials saw it and cried openly. They realized what a tragedy they'd created.
One might think that a man who has spent his whole life writing would be all written out. Does that describe your current feelings, Mr. Miller?
I still have lots to say and do. After writing Time Bends, I realized that I had plenty of things I wanted to talk about. So there will be at least one more book of memoirs, a play that I've been working on, and a new film that's ready for production.
I've heard that Time Bends has been translated into 20 languages.
Yes. In America, I've been criticized for not being scandalous enough. You know how it was really to be married to Marilyn Monroe. But in Europe, where the book is a bestseller, no one has complained about my not being open enough. After all, Marilyn was the saddest girl I ever met. I tried to encourage the child in her. Marilyn wanted a father, someone she could trust in.
Our time is up, Mr. Miller. In Time Bends, Mr. Miller frankly reveals the contrast between Marilyn's outward liveliness and keen wit and her constant awareness of death. He understood her, treated her with tenderness, and gave her all the love she was capable of receiving, but it wasn't enough.
Now listen to the same text in six sections. Look at question one.
Today in our studio, we have Mr. Arthur Miller, the famous playwright. Mr. Miller, where do you spend most of your time nowadays?
In Connecticut. Back in the 1950s, I bought 700 acres of land there, plus a farmhouse as old as the United States itself.
Arthur Miller's present wife, the photographer Inge Morath, has her studio in an old barn. There's a cottage where Mr. Miller can write undisturbed, and a well-equipped workshop. Mr. Miller is not merely a world-famous playwright, but also a first-rate carpenter. He's built all his bookcases himself.
Answer question one, then look at questions two and three.
Mr. Miller, tell me something about your background.
I was born in 1915. My father, Isidore Miller, an illiterate Jewish clothing merchant, immigrated from Poland at the age of seven and later made his fortune in New York. My father may have been unable to read, but he was all the better at counting money. But father lost most of his money in the Depression, and we moved from a luxury apartment to the relative poverty of Brooklyn. I used to work as a truck driver and a factory boy until I made my way to the University of Michigan.
Answer questions two and three. Then look at questions four and five.
There you won several literary prizes and came to realize that you had a knack for writing plays.
That's right, and I think the Depression sharpened my understanding of society and of people's suffering. But even so, prose has never come easily to me. My need to condense things developed early.
Mr. Miller, do you have some favorite critics?
Well, really, I have always detested the inhumanity of theater critics. The situation is actually worse than it was 20 or 30 years ago. The commercial theater manages to do all right, but no one wants to invest in quality. Today in America, theater is just showbiz.
Answer questions 4 and 5. Then look at questions 6 and 7.
When I read your autobiography, Time Bends, I got the impression that you have total recall regarding your own life.
But you have to understand, in my home, I was always considered the one with the worst memory. I've never kept a diary or done research for my autobiography. Everything I've written is just the way I remember it.
You have said that The Crucible, your most frequently performed play, measures the political climate of the country where it is played. Can you give me an example?
The Crucible, which is the story of a 17th century witch hunt and an allegory of McCarthyism in the 1950s, is often performed in countries afraid of dictatorship or where a dictatorship has just ended. In Poland in the mid-80s, several government officials saw it and cried openly. They realized what a tragedy they'd created.
Answer questions 6 and 7. Then look at questions 8 and 9.
One might think that a man who has spent his whole life writing would be all written out. Does that describe your current feelings, Mr. Miller?
I still have lots to say and do. After writing Time Bends, I realized that I had plenty of things I wanted to talk about. So there will be at least one more book of memoirs, a play that I've been working on, and a new film that's ready for production.
I've heard that Time Bends has been translated into 20 languages.
Yes. In America, I've been criticized for not being scandalous enough. You know, how it was really to be married to Marilyn Monroe. But in Europe, where the book is a bestseller, no one has complained about my not being open enough.
Answer questions 8 and 9. Then look at question 10.
After all, Marilyn was the saddest girl I ever met. I tried to encourage the child in her. Marilyn wanted a father, someone she could trust in.
Our time is up, Mr. Miller. In Time Bends, Mr. Miller frankly reveals the contrast between Marilyn's outward liveliness and keen wit and her constant awareness of death. He understood her, treated her with tenderness, and gave her all the love she was capable of receiving, but it wasn't enough.
Answer question 10. Here is the second part. Listen to it straight through.
I'll now tell you about a former teacher of mine. She's 80. I know this because I telephoned and asked her. 40 years ago, I thought she was 80. But then that's because I was 10 and she was a nun. I also know her real name now, and that was something we would have killed for to know back in the convent days. Mother St. Dominic, as she was in the days of my girlhood, could make anything interesting. I say this with gritted teeth and great envy, for I know, after 9 years teaching, that there are some things which are almost impossible to liven up. Somehow she approached everything in the right way. She didn't seem to know how deadly and bone-crushingly awful some of these topics were. And so she led us through trade winds and river deltas so cheerfully that we had learnt the whole package before its true deadliness had sunk in. She could even motivate us about trash. Ours was the only hockey pitch in Europe without a candy wrapper dropped nearby. We always thought she was English. We wove stories about her. Perhaps she was the daughter of an earl who wanted her to marry a duke. We assumed that her childhood was in the last century. She had run away and found a kindly convent to save her from the Duke. In fact, she told me this week that she was half Scottish and half Irish, that she'd grown up in a house only about 4 miles from our Irish convent. Mother St. Dominic had an uncontrollable laugh. It started as a giggle. It was completely infectious, and made her face turn bright red in an effort to stop herself. Word had come from the fourth form that it had happened during their religious knowledge class, when someone had asked how we knew for certain that Mary, mother of Jesus, didn't smoke. In a completely unsentimental way, she loved children. She cared about them, knew their limits, stretched them, but never forced them. She knew far too much about all of us. We wished that she couldn't read us so clearly like open books. But her generosity always made her skip the chapters she didn't like and settle on those she did. I asked her to my wedding reception, saying that it would be better than having Frank Sinatra, and it was. Everyone she taught has this memory of someone who really seemed to understand all the horrors and rages of being a child, and all the fears and hopes of being on the verge of adulthood. It was because of her that I became a teacher. And in my classroom, when faced with intractable, terrible children, I used to dream up her face and try to think how she might have handled them. In the hot summer of 1959, I went to the Holy Child's School in St. Leonard-on-Sea, telling her I wanted to teach, and asking if she could give me some help. She showed me more in 6 weeks than any degree or diploma ever taught anyone. She had no secret, no method, no style. What she did have was a belief that children were basically decent and could probably learn anything if you told it right. She doesn't sound 80 now. any more than she sounded 80 then. She said that it was perfectly all right for me to write about her, as long as I gave credit to the school, the Holy Child Convent, Killiney. But she hoped that I would not resort to sentimentality or exaggeration, which, if she remembered correctly, had been a weakness of mine some decades ago. Which means, of course, that I can't tell you what a great woman she is, and how deeply loved by the women whose lives she brightened up like a great star.
Now listen to the same text in 5 sections. Look at questions 11 and 12.
I'll now tell you about a former teacher of mine. She's 80. I know this because I telephoned and asked her. 40 years ago, I thought she was 80. But then that's because I was 10 and she was a nun. I also know her real name now, and that was something we would have killed for to know back in the convent days. Mother St. Dominic, as she was in the days of my girlhood, could make anything interesting. I say this with gritted teeth and great envy, for I know after 9 years teaching that there are some things which are almost impossible to liven up.
Answer questions 11 and 12, then look at questions 13 and 14.
Somehow she approached everything in the right way. She didn't seem to know how deadly and bone-crushingly awful some of these topics were. And so she led us through trade winds and river deltas so cheerfully that we had learnt the whole package before its true deadliness had sunk in. She could even motivate us about trash. Ours was the only hockey pitch in Europe without a candy wrapper dropped nearby. We always thought she was English. We wove stories about her. Perhaps she was the daughter of an earl who wanted her to marry a duke. We assumed that her childhood was in the last century. She had run away and found a kindly convent to save her from the duke. In fact, she told me this week that she was half Scottish and half Irish, that she'd grown up in a house only about 4 miles from our Irish convent.
Answer questions 13 and 14. Then look at questions 15 and 16.
Mother St. Dominic had an uncontrollable laugh. It started as a giggle. It was completely infectious and made her face turn bright red in an effort to stop herself. Word had come from the fourth form that it had happened during their religious knowledge class, when someone had asked how we knew for certain that Mary, mother of Jesus, didn't smoke. In a completely unsentimental way, she loved children. She cared about them, knew their limits, stretched them, but never forced them. She knew far too much about all of us. We wished that she couldn't read us so clearly like open books. But her generosity always made her skip the chapters she didn't like and settle on those she did.
Answer questions 15 and 16. Then look at questions 17 and 18.
I asked her to my wedding reception, saying that it would be better than having Frank Sinatra, and it was. Everyone she taught has this memory of someone who really seemed to understand all the horrors and rages of being a child, and all the fears and hopes of being on the verge of adulthood. It was because of her that I became a teacher, and in my classroom, when faced with intractable, terrible children, I used to dream up her face and try to think how she might have handled them.
Answer questions 17 and 18. Then look at questions 19 and 20.
In the hot summer of 1959, I went to the Holy Child's school in St. Leonard-on-Sea, telling her I wanted to teach, and asking if she could give me some help. She showed me more in 6 weeks than any degree or diploma ever taught anyone. She had no secret, no method, no style. What she did have was a belief that children were basically decent and could probably learn anything if you told it right. She doesn't sound 80 now, any more than she sounded 80 then. She said that it was perfectly all right for me to write about her, as long as I gave credit to the school, the Holy Child Convent, Killiney. But she hoped that I would not resort to sentimentality or exaggeration, which, if she remembered correctly, had been a weakness of mine some decades ago. Which means, of course, but I can't tell you what a great woman she is and how deeply loved by the women whose lives she brightened up like a great star.
Answer questions 19 and 20. This is the third and last part. Listen to it straight through, then in five sections. You have about 1 minute and a half to write your answer on the special answer sheet in English.
Everything except maybe new hair comes to him who waits. By the standards of immortality, Sean Connery hasn't been waiting long, a mere 60 years. Last year, an American magazine dubbed the grizzled, balding face of Connery on its cover, The Last Real Man in America. It was an opinion poll in the same country that decided that this twice-married grandfather was the sexiest man in the world. And lest you think that such titles can be bought, then the one honor that doesn't carry a price tag is convincing proof that he stands alongside such peers as Henry Fonda and Clark Gable. 3 years ago, Hollywood voted him one of the Oscars. There was one irony, though, that Connery is sure to have appreciated. After playing many leading roles, including James Bond, Connery won this gold-plated statuette as the best supporting actor in the gangland film The Untouchables. All these goodies falling on him in a heap have neither turned Connery's head nor weakened his will to work. Work has paid off richly recently. No fewer than three Sean Connery films have been shot and were ready for release in 1990. One of them is Family Business, directed by Sidney Lumet, who has made four earlier films with Connery, stars him as the patriarch of a tough hoodlum family in New York. Dustin Hoffman plays his son and Matthew Broderick his grandson, a smart spread of age groups designed to pull in the filmgoers of three generations. In another film, Connery plays a Russian submarine commander in an action thriller, The Hunt for Red October. What attracted Connery to the role was that it would not portray him only as an action man, but as a man with brains capable of thinking. Connery owns several apartments. They are all close to golf clubs, golf being his favorite way of relaxing. Connery is most comfortable with a lifestyle that settles around a well-run home and lets him go on enjoying his success in simple ways together with a few good old friends. At an age when most men are beginning to think of retirement or are eagerly looking forward to it, this man is at his peak.
Now listen to the same text in five sections. Look at question A.
Everything except maybe new hair comes to him who waits. By the standards of immortality, Sean Connery hasn't been waiting long, a mere 60 years. Last year, an American magazine dubbed the grizzled, balding face of Connery on its cover, The Last Real Man in America. It was an opinion poll in the same country that decided that this twice-married grandfather was the sexiest man in the world.
Answer question A. Look at question B.
And lest you think that such titles can be bought, then the one honour that doesn't carry a price tag is convincing proof that he stands alongside such peers as Henry Fonda and Clark Gable. 3 years ago, Hollywood voted him one of the Oscars. There was one irony, though, that Connery is sure to have appreciated. After playing many leading roles, including James Bond, Connery won this gold-plated statuette as the best supporting actor in the gangland film The Untouchables.
Answer question B. Look at question C.
All these goodies falling on him in a heap have neither turned Connery's head nor weakened his will to work. Work has paid off richly recently. No fewer than 3 Sean Connery films have been shot and were ready for release in 1990. One of them is Family Business, directed by Sidney Lumet, who has made 4 earlier films with Connery, stars him as the patriarch of a tough hoodlum family in New York. Dustin Hoffman plays his son and Matthew Broderick his grandson, a smart spread of age groups designed to pull in the filmgoers of 3 generations.
Answer question C. Look at question D.
In another film, Connery plays a Russian submarine commander in an action thriller, The Hunt for Red October. What attracted Connery to the role was that it would not portray him only as an action man, but as a man with brains capable of thinking.
Answer question D. Look at question E.
Connery owns several apartments. They are all close to golf clubs, golf being his favorite way of relaxing. Connery is most comfortable with a lifestyle that settles around a well-run home and lets him go on enjoying his success in simple ways together with a few good old friends. At an age when most men are beginning to think of retirement or are eagerly looking forward to it, this man is at his peak.
Answer question E.